Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551, ray@rte.ie. John Ronson is coming to Dublin next month, which is good news for his legion of fans in this country. Author of The Psychopath Test, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, The Men Who Stare at Goats. John is bringing his live show, Things Fell Apart, which is based on his hugely popular podcast, to Dublin's Liberty Hall on Friday, June 10th. And I'm delighted to say John is on the line now. Good afternoon, John.
Hi, Ray. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always.
Good to talk to you. So Things Fell Apart. I think it's an attempt by you to throw water on the raging fires of the culture wars. Is that it?
Yeah, or certainly on the intensity with which they're being fought. Like many, you know, obviously there's many culture wars that are fought for good reasons. However, something's happened the last few years that means they're being fought with such an intensity online that it's turning people. I mean, it's turning some people crazy. People are losing their families, they're losing their reputations, losing all of their work. It's swallowing them up. And I was watching this, sort of feeling quite melancholy. Like these talented people are just, you know, throwing everything away to fight a culture war. What's going on? What's happening? So that was my question. Why is this intensity happening now?
And for the purposes of your podcast, and maybe to help out our listeners, how do you define a culture war?
Sure. Maybe the best definition I read was the battle for dominance over conflicting values.
Right.
So the first big modern culture war, when I say modern, I think you go back to the early 1970s for the genesis of what's happening today. So the earliest ones were over abortion and over diversity of thought in school textbooks. The ones that are probably raging at their hottest right now are transgender rights and critical race theory. Those are the two big ones currently.
Okay, so we'll go through some of those. Roe versus Wade is back in the news in America. And in one of your episodes, you trace the origins of the violent reaction to abortion in America. And it's a story that starts with a father and son coupling, Francis and Frank Schaefer. Tell us about them.
I mean, this story I'm about to tell you is a completely unknown story and an extraordinary one. Francis Schaefer was a Christian art historian, kind of twinkle-eyed Willy Wonka sort of vibe about him in Switzerland in the late 60s. His son, Frank, was a very ambitious young man. He wanted to be big in Hollywood. So the Schaefers were given $3.5 million to make a documentary series about art history. And the young son had a personal bugbear about abortion. He was a teenage father at 19. This was about 5 years after Roe versus Wade, and the only people protesting Roe versus Wade at the time were Roman Catholics. Christian evangelists, it just wasn't an issue for them. It was a non-issue. They were pro-choice or ambivalent at best. As a result of this father and son making this documentary series with all of these very arresting visual images about a thousand dolls on the beach baking under the, you know, these yes. kind of visual images. He only put them in because he wanted a showreel to show Hollywood producers. That was his only ambition, was to make it in Hollywood. As a result of these documentaries and this arresting visual images, the entire Christian right anti-abortion movement began because of this father and son. And of course, doctors were murdered. And of course, now, 50 years later, Roe versus Wade is about presumably to be overturned again. And it's a manufactured, manipulated outrage, which is just so interesting. I guess we just don't care. Like when we're furious about something, we probably don't care why we're furious, whether we were manipulated.
And does it matter? You see, that's the thing, John. Does it matter? The origins of these things, does that actually matter?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think it's fascinating that faraway people, faraway men manipulated us all yes. into our rage. I mean, so I think it matters in that regard. I don't think it probably matters to the people who are doing the fighting right now, because when the flame is burning hot, we don't care how we got there.
It's listening to this and like, I found it really enlightening and engaging and entertaining and brilliant and really added to my understanding of what's happening in the world. But you can't sit everybody down and put a pair of headphones on them and insist that they listen to John Ronson's podcasts.
But you can force them all to come to Liberty Hall on June 10th.
No, you can, yes. And that brings me nicely on to the next question, John, because were you fearful at any stage? Because it is very black and white, isn't it? It's very polarised. So people are going to decide which side you're on and act accordingly.
Well, yeah, and that does happen from time to time. I feel very lucky that all of these years I've been quite immune to too much criticism. Because I tell stories with curiosity and empathy and kindness, and I tell human stories with twists and turns, and I try and avoid ideology as much as I can. I tend to not get attacked too much. And when I was making this show, I did think, only an idiot would make a show about the culture war, especially a conflict-averse idiot like me.
Yeah.
But a little part of me thought, if I tell human stories, everyone can relate to that.
Okay, and you do. And you, say, for example, you tell the story of QAnon through the story of Isaac Cappy. Tell us about him.
Isaac Cappy was a talented young man in Hollywood in the early 2000s. Hollywood, the edges of Hollywood are such melancholy places. People trying to make it and they can't make it because it's so competitive and you get more and more bleak feeling. And that's what was happening to Isaac. He had more successful friends than him. He was spending too much time on the internet. And he said to one of his more successful Hollywood friends, I'm beginning to think that there's a paedophile conspiracy in Hollywood. And his friend said, his friend looked very serious. And said it's true. And if you and I have a fake wall in my house, and if you come behind that fake wall, I have a child held captive. And now the guy was obviously playing a prank on.
Yes, and this is, with the context of this was Pizzagate and the fact that people believed that very powerful people in Washington had a paedophile ring which operated from the basement of a pizza restaurant just outside Washington.
Yeah, and a guy went into the pizza restaurant with a gun and discovered, to free the children.
Okay.
And discovered that not only were there no dungeons in the basement and no kidnapped children, there wasn't even a basement.
Right.
The pizza restaurant didn't have a basement.
So Isaac fell hook, line and sinker for this prank that his so-called friends played on him. And then he became a poster boy, did he, for QAnon and conspiracy theory?
Yeah, a thought leader. He became a thought leader for QAnon. We don't realise, these little human moments, Frank Schaefer's ambition to make Hollywood films, Isaac Cappy believing his friend's stupid prank, these little human moments are what are the pebbles thrown in the pond which have now turned into a hurricane.
Yeah, how does that work? You've obviously thought about this. How does a notional thing in somebody's brain turn into a mass movement with a lot of power? How does that? Is there a want in us as human beings to believe, to belong? What is it?
Yeah, and I think sort of magical thinking, for want of a better phrase, has been a part of human life forever. And I think part of the problem is that the internet has brought all the magical thinkers together. It used to be, I'm a magical thinker who believes in, UFOs or conspiracy theories over there, or wellness, or, paedophile cabals. Now they've all got together. They've all united. And the reason why they've united is because of the way that the billionaire tech utopian libertarians who created the internet designed the internet. The internet was designed for this chaos.
So it was designed to polarize. It was designed to divide. It was designed to appeal to extremes.
Yeah, all of those things, and also designed to allow free speech to just flourish unencumbered. Free speech in all of its myriad guises, including, lies and abuse and harassment. These libertarians who created the internet very strongly felt that free speech, just exactly what Elon Musk is saying today about, why he wants to buy Twitter. And we had no choice. That was the world we all lived in.
Well, let's talk about Twitter for a while, because I heard you say, I think, to Louis Theroux, a quote from the head of Twitter in England, we are the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. And Elon Musk is out there shouting from the rooftops that, you know, he wants to bring free speech back to Twitter, saying that he wouldn't have banned Donald Trump from Twitter. Is it right? Is it proper? Is it good for the world that a man can buy this power for $44 billion? What do you think?
Well, no, because it's free speech absolutism. They like to see themselves as unideological, but it's a very ideological position. Free speech absolutism. It really is. It's like, of course, it sounds good. Everybody wants, you know, every reasonable liberal person wants free speech to run, because you see the dangers of restricted speech. But yes, we've lived in this experiment for the last 30 years. And what happened? The fact is, what happened was you had people trying to destroy democracy. You had mass harassment. You had, you know, abuse. You had a proliferation of dangerous, dangerous lies. The fact is, right, like, I would always consider myself a free speech absolutist, but that experiment failed.
Okay.
And the fact is, if Elon Musk takes over Twitter and brings it all back again, Twitter will fail, because we don't, you know, society doesn't want that. Mm-hmm. A small group of people want it.
Yeah. Just on the culture war, is probably one of the big weapons, the sort of the nuclear option of the culture war is cancellation, isn't it? It's to cancel somebody. And I suppose you spoke about that in your book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. You were talking about it really before anybody else was talking about it. Where is it at now? I feel that public adult discourse on important things has been muted.
I mean, things are very bad and very extreme, because the whole cancel culture debate has become just a mess, because it just means so many different things to so many different people. It's a phrase, those two words incorporate a vast number of completely different sets of situations.
Okay. How do you understand it?
Well, for me, it means the disproportionate punishment of private individuals that haven't really done anything wrong.
Right.
Like, if a politician sexually assaults somebody and then, you know, bleats that they're being cancelled, that's a whole different thing.
Of course.
Putin talked about cancellation as part of his invasion of Ukraine. So all that stuff is clearly ridiculous. But then you've also got people on the left who say, oh, cancel culture doesn't exist. It's just holding people accountable, and it's always been that way. And there is some truth to that. There's some truth that if you're an agent provocateur columnist, you could be piled in on before the internet existed. Mm. But of course, the way that the internet goes means that those things have become much more extreme and much more ubiquitous. So there's some gaslighting going on when the left say that it doesn't exist, I'd say.
Right. Now, talk to me about Nancy. Nancy was a transgender woman, and you traced her story, and you attached it to the term TERF and some of the war that's going on around transgender politics at the moment.
Yeah, it's an interesting story how the word TERF came to be. Nancy, trans woman, she would go to this women-only festival called Mitch Fest in Michigan. And she went there 1 year and had a wonderful time. And there were other trans women there. I don't think very many, but there were other trans women there. Anyway, the second time she went, a woman went up to her and said, you know, you're not, are you a man? You're not welcome here. You have to leave. You have to leave now. And so she left. And they set up camp the following year, Camp Trans. And there's an argument that, you know, an awful lot of the modern transgender movement started at Camp Trans. And at the beginning, it was really a place to try and heal rifts between the two communities. And it worked for a while. There was, you know, meetings of minds and so on. Anyway, that obviously fell apart over the years. And the word TERF was originally invented about that particular incident. Should somebody like Nancy be allowed into this particular festival? And they tried to find a term for women who didn't want to allow trans women in, and the term was trans exclusion and radical feminist. Wasn't a term of abuse at all, but obviously, like everything else, it's become a term of abuse.
And you spoke to the woman who coined the phrase.
Yeah, and she's like, oh my God, you know, I wanted this to be a factual term. I didn't want it to be a thing that people like scream at each other about.
Because we've no control. Once we say something, we've really no control of it then.
It's a very difficult... I don't know. It's very, very hard for anybody to talk about, for people to talk about transgender issues, because it's such a minefield, and there's an awful lot of people involved who are very ready to argue in bad faith and scream and shout. And
okay, well,
and the whole thing is just so. It's like, yeah, how can you have any kind of civilised conversation or debate when it's that furious?
It appears to me there are no winners from this, because if you can't talk openly and ask questions about a marginalised group in society and get people familiar with the language, well, then it remains taboo in a way, you know? And if people like you, and I can hear it in your voice, are afraid to have open adult discussions, well, that's not good, is it? Is it?
Well, it's certainly not going to... Certainly not going to bring people into the fold.
No,
it's all it's going to do is make people stay away.
Yeah, Tammy Faye. Now, I don't know if you've seen the movie. You've seen the movie "The Eyes of Tammy Faye," which is it's a biopic of this female evangelist herself and her husband Jim, were some of the most famous TV evangelists in the States. And one particular interview she did, was a moment.
Yes, this is the reason why I think people should come to Liberty Hall on June the 10th.
Yeah, because this story.
Because everything we've talked about so far has been about why the world fell apart. I have a story, this beautiful story, which is about how things can come together. And it's about Tammy Faye. I actually did the story before
the movie.
I knew that was going to happen. I knew about this story for years, and I've always wanted to find a way to tell it, so I'm glad I got the opportunity. Tammy Faye Baker was a televangelist. Her peer group were extremely homophobic, to the extent that Jerry Falwell, the kind of lead televangelist, convinced Ronald Reagan to not say the word AIDS in public for 4 years.
Wow.
They wanted the virus to spread in silence. Tammy wasn't having this and invited a pastor with full-blown AIDS, a gay pastor with full-blown AIDS, onto her show. Never had anything like this ever happened before. And I kind of don't want to say what happened.
People, if people saw the movie, they'll know about Pastor Steve Peters, and it is an amazing story. And what I'm interested in, and maybe you might know because you spoke to Tammy Faye Baker's son Jay, in the film, and that's sort of, you know, for dramatic effect, it looked like her world was falling apart as she did this, and maybe it was sort of a reaction to what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, she was being... I mean, I know a lot about the Tammy Faye story. I could do Mastermind on
this. That'd be a good one. It seems like they're looking for new topics. People come with the same things over and over again. Kardashians.
Right. Now somebody's already done Randy Newman.
Right.
Tammy was being ostracised by her peer group, and she had various anxiety and depressive disorders, or certainly anxiety disorders. She started wearing makeup. She wore more and more makeup, and her peer group would call her like a French whore. You know, they'd insult her for her makeup, and then she'd put on more makeup. It was like a suit of armour. And so she was being mocked and ridiculed by her own peer group, and she was very alone. And I think what's so interesting is that in her loneliness, she found herself identifying more with the objects of her peer group's scorn than with her peer group themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's something for all of us, you know. Sometimes it's sometimes identifying with the objects of scorn can take you to a new place.
She was not dissimilar to Dolly Parton, and she was a singer and used to break into song in the middle of her shows. And there's a lovely moment in the I'm just teasing them here, John, not telling them. There's a lovely moment in the podcast where Pastor Steve Peters does his own version of this song. So if you're doing nothing over the weekend or next week or whatever, you can watch that movie and listen to John Ronson's podcast. Or you can go along to Dublin's Liberty Hall on Friday, June 10th. Things fall apart. John, are you hopeful for the world? Because it's black and white, isn't it? The nuances, the greyness in the middle, which is the reality of life, seem to have disappeared in a lot of places.
I'm hopeful to the extent that I think a younger generation coming along are more interested in the nuances and the ambiguities than their older siblings. I think, you know, I think 12-year-old kids today are like, do we really want to live under this incredibly frightening set of rules that our older siblings have created? Or if we say something slightly wrong in our lives? So that's where I'm hopeful, is that.
And will we ever reach a time where the big tech companies are answerable for what they let go through their platforms?
Oh, gosh, I wish.
It has to happen, though. Does it not have to happen? No, it doesn't have to happen. I'm naive, am I?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I hope that if Elon Musk buys Twitter, it's a disaster and he loses billions and he goes back to what he should be doing, which is creating an exciting utopian future of quiet cars and quiet aeroplanes.
Right. It's always great talking to you, and people can hear those stories that we've touched on in more detail and many more if they go to Dublin's Liberty Hall on Friday 10th of June. Things Fell Apart, a live show based on the hugely popular podcast. John Ronson, thank you very much. Mind yourself.
You too, Ray. Thank you.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.